Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance on Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Right now, and we're going to do this quickly because every second matters with Susan Collins. It's very simple. She is associated with the University of Michigan, but far more, her sterling academics that we've seen from Susan Collins at Harvard and then deep down the Charles River to MIT. And of course, as Michael McKee goes, plunging across to near South Station in the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. Michael McKee with Susan Collins.
Thank you very much, Tom. We have the Boston Fed president here with us in Washington, and we'd like to thank you for joining us today here at Bloomberg and to our audience around the world on Bloomberg Radio and Television. Thank you for joining us. Let's start with the numbers because they just came out. Personal income up 0.3, personal spending 0.2, and then the PCE indicator, which of course is the Fed's favorite, 0.3 for the headline, 0.3 for the core. What does this tell you about the state of the economy and where the Fed is in its inflation fight?
So let me start by saying just absolutely delighted to be here with you. Look forward to our conversation. And of course, I haven't had a chance to dig deeply into the numbers yet. And sometimes the details actually are important in terms of understanding the story. But starting with the PCE inflation, that's about what was expected. That is some positive news. At the same time, let me say two things about that. One is that the monthly data are really noisy. We've seen that. And so 1 month of move in a kind of more helpful direction is not something that really indicates a sustained change. And the other thing I'll say is that if you recognizing the elevated numbers we saw in December and January, this a bit lower number that we expected just means that the 3-month average is about what the 12-month average is. And so that's not a lot of progress. We still do have more work to do and more to see to know that inflation is really on a sustained downward path.
Well, you're on record as saying you favor at least one more move by the Fed. Does this sort of lock it in for May that you do it because inflation is still at a high level and you don't pause for a month to see how things are going?
Well, actually, what I think I'm on record as saying is that I'm highly data dependent. And so my assessment at the last meeting just last week with the summary of economic projections did suggest an additional rate hike and then pausing and holding over the year. But I need to assess all of the data that's going to come in between now and when our next meeting is in early May. And, where I am at the moment, the new data that I've seen just in the past week has not materially changed how I'm thinking about things, but I certainly don't make a decision this far in advance about what I'm going to think is the right thing to do.
Well, the markets have looked at all the data, and they're pricing in 4 rate cuts this year. Are traders crazy?
What I would say is obviously there's a range of views about these things. I mean, look, inflation is just really too high. When we talk about price stability, to me, what that means is a level of low, stable inflation where no one's thinking about inflation. Well, everybody is thinking about inflation, and that really does mean We have more work to do, and what history has told us is that you need to have conditions sufficiently tight and then really hold the course in order to know that you have, in a sustainable way, gotten inflation going back to what the target is.
Well, spending was down during, not down, but decelerated significantly during the month of February, according to this report. Do you worry about going too far and tipping the country into recession? That's the standard view of what the Fed does.
It is absolutely a balance, and I think it's important to recognize that there are uncertainties, there are risks, and in particular, we do need to balance the risk that we don't do enough, that we're not sustained, don't hold the course, and don't bring inflation down. And again, as I mentioned before, inflation is really costly to businesses and households, and so that's important. At the same time, you're absolutely right. I do monitor the data, looking at when we might see the economy turning. And some of the slower data, I think, is helpful in that context. That's what we would hope to see. At the same time, early days yet in terms of assessing whether we really have gone as far as we need to go.
Well, in terms of assessing, have you got any assessment of what impact the recent banking issues will have on the economy? There's a theory out there banks are going to tighten credit and do some of your work for you, and that could also send us into recession.
That is certainly an important factor. There's absolutely a theory out there, and we could see some of that. My expectation is that we're likely to see at least some, but we'll have to continue to really monitor the data and see what happens in terms of how things evolve. But, you know, as I've said, I had expected early in March that I might think we would need to do more work, and the banking stresses and what I think is at least a possible response of banks in terms of their own liquidity needs has influenced that. And so it's certainly one of the important things to factor. You know, one of the things I do want to just emphasize is I continue to see, given the resilience in our economy, that there's a pathway that we can bring inflation down without a significant downturn. And so monitoring holistically the range of data and that balance that we just talked about is a really important factor in that outlook.
Do you think the Fed bears any responsibility for what happened with the banks because they raised rates, interest rates so fast and so far?
I think that there were a number of mistakes and challenges that were made. I also think it's really important that the review that Vice Chair Barr is conducting, that's underway, be thorough, unfettered, and that we not kind of prejudge what the lessons and findings from that report are going to be, but we commit with a bit of a sense of humility that we will take those findings really seriously and act on them to continue to strengthen what I see as already a sound and resilient banking system.
Well, what are banks in your district telling you about their situation?
So, of course, we monitor very closely, and we are in close contact with the banks throughout the First District, which is most of New England. And what we're seeing is that they are very focused on their activities to really support the communities throughout our district. The, you know, as you know, small and medium banks play a critical role in a vibrant economy. And they also, you know, are particularly focused on what some of the risks might be, especially in the aftermath of some of the stresses that we've seen. And so we very much work to support those activities and appreciate the work that they're doing.
You and your colleagues talk a lot about the cumulative impact of your rate increases. Is that hitting now? Has that hit? When do we really see 5% Fed funds rate have an impact?
Yeah, so that's a really important question. And the way that I think about it is that there are absolutely lags. There's some sectors, some parts of the economy that see the increase in rates and they respond relatively quickly. And I would put housing markets there. We certainly saw responses in housing markets to tighter financial conditions relatively quickly, and that's what we would expect. At the same time, other markets, such as labor markets, often are impacted over time. And it really is only in the second half of 2022 that our interest rates got to a broader range that were quite restrictive. And so my assessment is that it will still be some time, but over the coming quarters, we really should see other sectors of the economy respond to the tightening that is already kind of factoring through the system.
Well, I guess we'll check back with you in the fall. One last question, Tom Keene. Since I know the Red Sox lost yesterday and you're on record as saying that the season is over, let me ask the Boston Fed Bank president, one loss, is the season over for the Red Sox?
Absolutely not. And we look forward to our Red Sox and our other teams having a wonderful season and many exciting games ahead.
All right, Tom, somebody
she
for you
nailed
to debate
that.
With.
She absolutely nailed that.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Michael Zeldin is described by that adjunct professor at American University, Washington College of Law. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. What was your first day at Justice like ages ago? Is the Justice Department now the same Justice Department where you walked in out of Binghamton in your legal practice years ago?
I believe it is. I believe that under Merrick Garland, they are committed to the rule of law and to following the facts and the law and to dispense justice even handedly. So, yes, I think they are.
What will we see Tuesday if we have a presumed arraignment of X number of items? Can you prejudge that or pre-analyze that?
Well, we can guess that Trump is going to be charged with a campaign file violation, campaign law violation, and a business records violation. The business records will probably be 10 or 12 different business entries that reflect payment to Michael Cohen as legal fees, which were in fact repayment of the Stormy Daniels $130,000 hush money payment. So we might see a 10 or 12 count indictment, but really it boils down to one hush money payment by Cohen to Stormy Daniels and then a 10-part or 12-part reimbursement of Cohen for that. That is a business crimes offense in New York, and it is a misdemeanor. They can make it a felony if they say that those payments were made as part of a other crime, and that other crime is a federal campaign elections crime, a theory not previously tested in New York. So it's not a simple case, but that I think will be the outline of what we'll see on Tuesday.
Michael, there are people who are watching this who are frustrated to be dragged back into wall-to-wall circus coverage of this question of, you know, hush money paid to people who may or may not have had affairs. This is really one consequence of an era that a lot of people want to perhaps move on from, move forward, and yet the erosion of the trust in the judicial system continues. How much do prosecutors weigh this type of social response when deciding whether to go forward?
It's part of the calculus, but it shouldn't be the primary calculus. The primary calculus has to be, were laws violated, and is accountability required for that law violation? And I think that in this case, though it's an old case by, you know, current standards, it is a case that I think the Manhattan District Attorney's Office felt accountability was required, and therefore they brought it. Now, yes, it's true that people would like to move on from this, but people would like to move on from January 6th, and there needs to be accountability there. And people want to be moving on from all sorts of things in the Trump era. But we still need a reconciliation with what occurred so that we can learn from it and move forward as a country away from it.
Given the fact that you just talked about the nature of this particular crime, do you think that there will be blowback to the New York prosecutors going forward with this?
There already is. I mean, he's already been labeled as a Soros-funded liberal and a racist by the former president. So, yes, I think that part of the strategy in the court of public opinion is going to be to demonize Bragg and try to delegitimize the prosecution.
Michael, it's the oddest thing, folks. I remember exactly where I was standing on the OJ decision years ago, and you provided the nation with legal coverage at that time. Michael Zeldin, Donald Trump was 27, 28 years old in 1974, where Wilbur Mills and, you know, it was in the Jefferson Tidal Basin and the scandal and uproar then, and the 14 other scandals you followed. Is the job changed for federal prosecutors because of the cultural acceptance of this or that vice along the way? Is the job now of your world totally different than it was in 1974?
Well, yes and no. So when Wilbur Mills and Fannie Fox fall into the tidal basin, I don't think people were talking then in Me Too terms. I think that was thought of as, well, that's just the way the system works. Now, in the aftermath of the Me Too movement, I think that sort of behavior is intolerable, and that's good. And so I think, for example, had Bill Clinton done what he did with Monica Lewinsky now, he would have been removed from the office of president. I think that we're at a better time now than we were then with respect to this misogynistic behavior.
Michael Zeldin, for our audience international, what should they look for on Tuesday when we get this arraignment? How should we approach the news frenzy that we're going to see?
I really think that a lot of that depends on how Donald Trump wants to play this. That is to say, if he wants to do what the Justice Department would like to do, or the Manhattan District Attorney's Office would like to do, he'll come in through a private entrance in a car. He'll go up in the judge's elevator. He'll go into the courtroom. He'll make his not guilty plea. He'll be fingerprinted and mugshot. He'll go back down that elevator and leave. And that will be the end of the day, a one-hour process. If he elects to make a spectacle of it, wanting to be handcuffed or go out in front of the court and talk about how he's the most persecuted person in the history of America, then you'll have a street scene that really won't be controllable as easily. So hopefully he'll do the right thing and just try this case in the court of law. But, you know, Donald Trump is Donald Trump, and he'll do what he thinks is in his best interest, irrespective of whether it's in the national or the city's best interest.
Michael Zeldin, thank you for joining Bloomberg Surveillance this morning. He is a former federal prosecutor, years of public service in our Department of Justice. Elon Musk, meet Jim Bianco. Jim Bianco is what Twitter is all about, and he is definitively led on Twitter in this banking crisis with intelligent threads. He joins us right now. Have the flows stopped? The deposit flows, the money market flows, where are we right now?
It hasn't stopped, but it has slowed down a little bit. But it is still, if you go back to prior to March 8th, a huge number of money is moving from the banks to higher yielding alternatives, whether it's money market funds or it's treasury bills or ETFs that are very short term. The public has woken up. They've found out that I'm getting zero at the bank. I can get 4.5 in something else. If you have $250,000, that's in the bank. That's like 15 grand a year or 14 grand a year. And they're making that move. They have been, and they're not stopping.
Is it still destabilizing? There seems to be a zeitgeist out there that, well, that was harsh, Silicon Valley and all that, but we're through that. And now there'll be a lesser instability. Do you buy it?
Yes and no. Yes, the initial response that Is another bank going to fail? Probably not at this point. Is there going to be another hemorrhage? Hopefully not. But is the public going to slow down? Are they going to say, I'm fine with 2 basis points, literally, at my Chase account, and I'll just leave my money there? No, they're not going to do that either. So the flow, I think, away from the low-yielding bank deposits to high-yielding alternatives will continue, and that will continue to pressure banks as they struggle to understand their deposit base.
So let's talk about those money market funds, which reached $5.2 trillion is the latest data from ICI that came out on Wednesday. We have seen it increase at an astronomical pace over the past 2 weeks with $100 billion alone. Over the past 4 weeks, more than $300 billion of inflows, which is taking us back to the pandemic era. Where do you expect this to go? What are you looking for when this hits the breaking point at a time when you're also starting potentially to see the ramifications of the rate hikes and other capacities?
I think once you see the spread between deposit rates and market rates collapse and basically offer the same deal, as long as, like I said, as long as you get 1% or less in the bank and you can get more than four in a money market fund, that is going to continue. Also keep in mind, in the post-financial crisis era, 75% of the money that is invested by a money market fund is either in a T-bill or a Fed reverse repo. So in the old days, pre-2009, you'd say, well, the money's going to money market funds. They buy commercial paper, and they still fund corporate America. And they still do that, but not nearly to the degree that they used to. They're funding the government, and they're funding the Fed now.
So translate this into 6 months from now and what this means in terms of access to credit, either defaults or simply firings and sort of a restraint with respect to business plans. How much more do you see that than perhaps is getting priced in?
Well, I do worry about that. Collectively, the regional banks are $6.8 trillion in assets. Collectively, they're larger than J.P. Morgan and Bank of America combined. So collectively, they matter. They fund 80% of commercial real estate, 50% of personal loans, 40% of commercial and industrial loans. If they've lost visibility on their deposit base and they don't know what's driving their depositors and their depositors are leaving and going somewhere else, they're going to pull back on their lending. A quick point, when we talk about banks, I always like to ask people, what do you think a bank is? And most people would say it's a warehouse where I keep my money and I get an interest rate. Okay, that is the definition of a bank. But for regulators and bankers and everybody else, it's a credit intermediation. It's a way to get a loan. It's a way to extend a business. And if the warehouse of money is going somewhere else, that lending action is going to really change.
We're seeing that in the price of bank stocks. Where are we not seeing this priced in?
Well, the thing about bank stocks is there's two things about them. Are they pricing in potential more defaults or failure? Or what I think they're pricing in is a squeeze of their margins because they're going to have to raise deposit rates and their profitability is going to be under pressure. That's why the bank stocks have not really recovered because there's a worry that in order to get past this problem, they have to start making less money.
Let's bring it back to the Fed. Economic data here in 7 minutes. Michael McKee will join us with that. Jim Bianco, the Fed here, and we had no landing, this landing, O'Hare landing, whatever the landing is. What's the efficacy of a pause right now? Or as I mentioned earlier in the show, how about three pauses? Pause, 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 just to wait to see to get to July to see where we are. Is a pause a good thing?
If we continue to have a credit crisis or credit problem, yes. But the Fed is not thinking pause right now. They're thinking about inflation. They're thinking about a pre-March 8th world and whether or not we are going to continue to see, you know, high inflation, persistent inflation, a no landing, a strong economy. If that's what they believe, they're going to continue to move forward with their rate hikes. But if we start to see a slowdown in credit, that should lead them to a pause.
Cubs, White Sox, what do you think? What's the story in Chicago this year?
Yeah, they're both 100% right now, 1-0, and we're at the Cody Bellinger era in the north side of town, and we're still in the Tim Anderson era in the south side of town.
Which way are you tilting? I mean, who are you going to see? This is a hugely important Midwest thing.
It really is. At this point, I hate to say it, but I'm kind of leaning towards the Cubs. I've always kind of had a bias for the White Sox, but the Cubs are the more interesting team right now.
So we got news we can use there. You see that?
South side. Oh, let's go.
Jim Bianco, thank you. And Jim, congratulations on being definitive on Twitter. I mean, if Elon Musk needs to know anything about the communicative thrust in the crisis of Twitter, there's other people out there as well. But Bianco's doing these threads. You can just feel all of Twitter just stops and goes, oh, God, another Bianco thread. I got to read it.
It's a continuation of the amazing notes and the amazing reports that he's put out for decades.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Joining us now and all timely is Matt Luzzetti. He's chief U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank, who had a shocking call long ago and far away of economic slowdown, but was emphasizing it would be out there somewhere where so many others were looking for immediate economic slowdown. We recalibrate this morning with Matt Luzzetti. I guess we see disinflation out there. Can you establish off this data disinflationary vectors in goods and services?
Yeah, I think we need to put the disinflation into context. It's still a 0.3% core PCE, month-on-month print, still well above the Fed's objective. 4.6% year-on-year is well above the Fed's objective. We were expecting this to be a bit softer than CPI, in part because airfares were much weaker in the PCE data. We'll have to see what we get in the core services ex shelter, which has been Chair Powell's main focus. But I think what we'd see from this data is a little bit softer than expected, but still well above the Fed's objective.
Still, to Mike's point, I mean, this is basically inflation perhaps not as hot, but growth also slowing perhaps more than people had expected. At what point does that story start to get priced in more? In other words, not exactly supportive of this robust, we can make it through anything kind of narrative.
Yeah, we saw it yesterday with the GDP revisions, consumer spending revised down. Basically, the domestic economy didn't grow in Q4. We have an alternative version, GDI, was actually negative in Q4. So I do think you have some evidence of slowing in the economy. We have to be cognizant you had a lot of strength in January, and so a lot of this is a give back to that. I think it all comes down to the labor market. You know, do we eventually begin to see that to soften? Do we eventually begin to see employment gains slowing? Unemployment insurance rolls picking up? I think that's the key question from the Fed's perspective.
A lot of people are wondering whether the Fed's going to cut rates later this year in the face of whatever weakness right now materializes later as a greater weakness. How is the response going to be at a time when you do say that inflation is well above their targets? They need to bring it down, but it is going down, and a lot of people think it will continue to do so as time grinds on.
Yeah, I think, you know, inflation is obviously well above their objective. The way that Chair Powell has been talking about the labor market is it's either extremely tight or tight to an unhealthy degree. And so there's no difference in or tension in their dual mandate at this point. I think the real issue comes when that tension arises. We think it begins to arise this year as you see the unemployment rate begin to increase at a time where inflation is still well above their objectives. You know, their own forecast at the end of this year have 4.6% on the unemployment rate, about 3.6% on core PCE, and them not cutting at this point. We expect that they cut rates in January, but a lot of it depends on how this credit shock plays out. You know, certainly it could mean that the recession's earlier, labor market weakens earlier, and the Fed has to cut earlier.
Susan Collins will be with us in 10 minutes with Michael McKee. She's absolutely definitive academics, as are you from UCLA, and she has a Harvard MIT heritage. And she's been at Michigan. And Michigan has a cottage industry of studying inflation and price change. When they debate at the Fed, and whether voting or non-voting, when Susan Collins leans forward and talks about inflation, does she talk about the same inflation that Peter Hooper talks about, or that Mohamed El-Erian talks about, or that Lyle Brainard talks about? Is everybody on the same page on what to look at?
Yeah, I think her speech yesterday was very clear. She broke down the basket into the three components that Chair Powell has been emphasizing: core goods, shelter, and core services ex shelter. I thought what was most interesting from her comments yesterday is she used a language about rate hikes that was a bit different than the statement. She said that additional tightening will likely be necessary, you know, not May, which is what the statement indicated. I thought that was a firmer indication of another rate hike, at least at the May FOMC meeting. That's our base case at the moment. But I was surprised about that.
I opened the Quinnipiac game for him yesterday with the slew rate of this rate rise. It's just incredible how quick we got here, and in hindsight, maybe too quick. What's the efficacy of a pause? When you at Deutsche Bank sit around and say, lift, cut, or pause, to me, a pause gives you optionality. Am I wrong on that?
No doubt it can, but I think it's a multifaceted question. You know, if they pause, what does the market do in response to that? You know, we have a market that has been pricing rate cuts earlier than the Fed has wanted. If they pause, what happens with that? I think rate cuts come much sooner and earlier, and I think that's a difficult
dynamic.
Really,
they can't pause and say, we're just pausing to see the data, even if we think it's going up.
I think it's very difficult for them to pause and not pull forward the market's pricing of rate
that's
cuts.
Interesting, that's key.
I'm a bit distracted over here because I'm trying to understand this market movement, and it basically seems to say a soft landing looks more certain after this data comes out. What's your take on that? I mean, do you think that what we have seen from the data, from the response mechanism, from central bankers, that we're heading closer or further away from a soft landing?
So I think it all depends on how you're viewing this credit shock. We think it can be material, but to be quite honest, at the moment, it's speculative because we don't have data on how it's playing out. You know, we're looking towards the Fed Senior Loan Officer Survey in early May. Everybody is. We're looking at the H8 data later today to see what's happening with C&I loans, CRE loans. What we saw out of the Fed's balance sheet data yesterday was supportive. It's, you know, things are not getting worse. We saw an aggregate reduction in their lending facilities so far. But we do think that credit conditions are going to tighten. The way that we've tried to quantify it suggests it could be anywhere from 0.5% on growth to certainly more than 1%. But at this point, it's difficult to gauge. If that does tighten, I think it certainly means hard landing is more likely than even we were anticipating.
Moments ago, Lisa, oil, $75 a barrel. American oil from that 69 level up to 75. Just an example of this correlated lift away from all the gloom.
This feeling we're going to make it through. I mean, oil has been its own animal with a lot of other specific stories, but there has been this feeling we will get through. And if there is some sort of downturn, it will be short and shallow was the theme. And now it's maybe we won't get one, the no landing, and maybe we're back to that. Do you still believe that if we prolong some sort of recession, it will be a worse recession?
Not necessarily. I think the way that we typically think about this is imbalances can build up the longer that this goes on, and therefore the recession can be deeper, more protracted as you have to delever. You know, this time around, we haven't seen the imbalances being built. You have household balance sheets that are in very good shape. You have a housing market that is already going through the correction. You know, we haven't seen overbuilding certainly take place there. So our view is still that this is a moderate recession. It looks a lot like the early 1990s. We've always thought it happens in the second half of this year and haven't really changed that view. I think it's consistent with what we're seeing. I would not say that just because we got a 0.3% on core PCE that we've shifted to a soft landing type narrative here. You know, inflation is still well too high for the Fed's liking.
Equity's lifting here as well, and the two-year yield comes in 4.10. We're looking at the two-year, folks, just because of the banking crisis. It's got some more information than 3.52 on the 10-year yield. Let's review your home run call. You came out, said recession. Everybody got all bent out of shape. But what you really did is said recession in late 2023. How do you nudge that out? What economic data would force you to move your recession call that's been fabulous into 2024?
Yeah, I think it's, again, all about the labor market.
The jobs. It's about labor.
And what are you seeing? And not only because it's, you know, if you see the unemployment rate rise, it's always, you know, shows a recession is happening. But the labor market tells us about the underlying strength in the consumer and household. And so if we're producing strong wage gains, strong income gains, the idea that the consumer can remain resilient in the recession further off is the key question.
I mean, it's a Luzzetti statistic. I missed it yesterday because I was doing the Quinnipiac thing. Claims 191 to 198.
Yeah.
We're going to stop the show right now and get some humility with Daniel Ives. He's senior equity analyst at Wedbush now, who absolutely nailed have courage, stay with Apple. You've heard me tell this story before. A zillion reasons Apple was going to blow up ago. Lawrence Haverty and I stood on Fifth Avenue and discussed all the reasons the Apple game was done. It's not. There were so many reasons to sell Apple 90 days ago. What did you see 90 days ago that gave you confidence to be long Apple?
It's the install base of Apple is still underappreciated by investors. And I think ultimately what we've seen with our checks in Asia is that demand, despite many yelling fire in a crowded theater, has actually held in more Rock of Gibraltar. And as that's played out, that's the key.
Let's get out front of Mark Gurman here, who owns the high ground on Apple technology gossip and all that. Is part of your calculus of Apple hire a new chip? Because to me, it's the chips at the bedrock of why they do well. Are we going to see new chips with this June meeting or soiree or whatever they're having?
Well, I think you'll have, and you're going to have chips as well as the AR, VR in terms of Apple Glass. And I think it just shows that even though many say innovations in the rearview mirror, you have the biggest install base in consumer, and now you're just further monetizing with services. And I think in these environments, you can never underestimate how bad a management team is or just how good. The tactician, the Hall of Famer Cook, I think is again going to navigate Apple, in our opinion, back to a $3 trillion market cap.
When can we stop calling it big tech and talk about communication companies and hardware companies and cloud companies and something much more specific that caters to a very different cycle than perhaps each of the companies combined?
Well, I think that's starting to happen. I mean, if you look at cloud, you look at Microsoft and what Nadella is doing to Redmond, that demand's held up, and that started to seep in what we've seen with Benioff at Salesforce and the broader group. Cybersecurity, I think, is a pocket of strength. But I think overall, and Lisa, you hit it on a great, in terms of big tech, the cost cutting, once that started to happen, the bottom in tech, in my opinion, was done. And that's why I believe there's still another 10 to 15% upside in tech.
But there's a 10 to 15% upside at a time when a lot of people think that it's already gotten overblown. That said, there are different kinds of job cuts. There are job cuts because you have excess, because you overhired, and because you have a lot of perhaps excess weight. There's also the kind of cuts that come because you see the potential for growth diminishing at a time when possibly you cannot borrow the same kind of way and there potentially is less demand. And, oh yeah, people already loaded up on devices and on services during the pandemic. How do you distinguish between the two?
Yeah, and I think you see it in terms of profitless tech and frothy tech. A lot of that really hasn't come back. But I think what you're seeing with a lot of bigger tech, or I'll say high-quality tech, they've cut costs. They were spending 1980s rock stars. That stopped. And now numbers have stabilized. And also on the other side of this now, you are seeing strong demand that's really starting to come back despite this macro. And I think that's what we've seen with Apple specifically in China.
When you talk about China, we'll get there in a second. But just going forward, are there any tech names that you do not think will participate in this gain of 15 to 20% as you predicted?
Look, I think when you look at shared donors and when you look at the Ciscos, some of the hardware players, what's really ultimately happening is the likes of Microsoft, you're seeing some bigger tech players more and more, like a Palo Alto and cybersecurity, further expand. Mm-hmm. And I think the ultimate headline of 1Q earnings is going to be, wow, didn't fall off a cliff. And I view that as more something I embrace rather than fear in terms of 1Q. And right now, look, the New York City cab driver is bearish on tech, and I continue to like that dynamic as it plays out.
Oh, it's time for the gossip hour here at Bloomberg Surveillance, and we can always do that with a well-dressed Dan Ives. A Disney-Apple mating. That, to me, is just like an IB frenzy there. I mean, the lunches at the Sunset Tower Hotel, Mr. Cook's hanging out with Mr. Iger in there at the Sunset Tower. Ives is over a couple tables. The bankers are surrounded. Any ability for Apple to acquire Disney?
Look, I think it's a possibility. I think the difference now for Apple is that this is the first time, I think, really in their history that they're going to have to significantly look at M&A. I think when you look at Disney, I think if TikTok's potentially on the table, depending on what happens with CFIUS in terms of a forced deal, I think this is the time that Cupertino, that's really never done M&A, is going to have to look at this. And look, if Disney comes That's something that strategically as a marriage makes a ton of sense and a creative.
My take on this, and I'm not going to try to be Moffat Nathanson here or Daniel Ives, is these mergers always fall apart when non-creatives take over the creative process. Do you have the confidence that Apple management can be humble enough to let Disney and the creatives like Mr. Iger be creative?
Yeah, I think that's something that I think uniquely they could balance that, because ultimately if you look at that marriage, what that could do, Apple and Disney, that would really be the golden goose. And I think something that Apple's been missing, as we know, is content, and that's something in terms of streaming services. That's going to be a $100 billion business in terms of services. I think that's going to be the next leg of the stool. Gurman talks about this all the time. Services, that is the really jewel that I think has been the key re-rating here in Apple.
You mentioned TikTok, you mentioned China, and with respect to Apple, and how much is this the fly in the ointment? We hear that Tim Cook is heading to China potentially in April. This is being reported by Reuters this morning. Is this going to become a liability for companies at a time of increasing tensions between the U.S. and China?
Look, Cook's part politician, part CEO, and I think what he's been able to do as a tactician better than anyone out there is tightrope, because ultimately Apple, it's basically 100% iPhone production, 20% of demand, but that ultimately continues to be part of their success.
Slow news day. You're at 190 on Apple, up 17%. When are we going to get an Ivesian lift above $200?
Look, I think right now...
I got to make some news, Dan.
In terms of our check, this is a stock that I believe is going to, you know, have, I believe, back to the $3 trillion market cap over the
what
next 3 to 6
months. What price is that
right
now?
Look, I think you start to look at, you know, ultimately, you start to look now, what I believe, $15, $20 upside from here, we start to approach $3 trillion.
I didn't get it out of him. He's, you know, he's got compliance on him.
Dan Ives, thank you. That was wonderful.
I
thought that was really interesting, especially given that so many people are shrugging off the story of tech preeminence right now as simply people pricing in lower rates and that pulling the story right back. And it seems like the efficiency story coming in perhaps in a more significant way.
Wait a minute. Qantas, I'm surrounded by Mets fans. I just figured, look at this.
Let's go Mets.
It's a Mets-a-thon. Verlander looked pretty good there.
I think this is the year for the Mets.
Sides.
Are you going? Are you going, you know, like this weekend or soon with a horde?
I'm going to go crawl into bed and stay there for the whole weekend, like I think everybody in the market is, because I think it's been an exhausting couple of weeks, and I think that I'm looking for, you know, just a dark, quiet space. You understand
that,
don't you?
We call that the land of the Boston Red Sox. go away. Dan Ives with us from Wedbush.
Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.